So what is the machayev of Josh? How does Josh have a debt to me, despite the fact that he didn't borrow anything from me, he didn't break any of my stuff, he didn't buy anything from me, he didn't work for me, I didn't work for him. How does he end up with a debt? So we saw basically five views in the Rishonim, assuming that we're understanding all of them correctly. One was Rashi simply seems to say that his exeris akasav, that's a pasuk. The pasuk is a surprising one. The pasuk is in Vayigash, and it has to do with the pasuk in Mikates. Really, both in there's a pasuk in Vayigash and a pasuk in Mikates. Both make references to Arvenu or Av, and the context there is Yehuda taking on the responsibility of Binyamin. So that pasuk apparently is enough to be mechayev us. The Gemara in the end of Bava Basra mentions that pasuk, also mentions the Hanoa factor. And here Rashi says on our daf, Moshe Metzina B'Torah, Shar Mishtab G'malva Ani Yechol Mumot. Apparently you can learn out from the Din of the Torah that there is such a thing. That's enough for us. So maybe that's just saying it's Gzeres HaKasav. That was one interpretation. Second interpretation we saw is that some of the Rishonim believe that a person can take on a hischaivus because he wants to. It doesn't have to be any other obligating factor. If you just say, I want to owe you money, boom, you can owe that person money. And that's the view of the Rambam in Hilchos Mechira, in which context he mentions Arif too. And apparently that's what happens here. He says, I am mechaiv you, and that's what does it. So where does the Hana come in? So maybe for the Rambam it comes in order to address any potential asmachta issues. And maybe for the Ritva, as a similar statement, it comes in to serve as the kinyan. That even if we're going to say you are being mechayiv yourself, you still need a kinyan to create that chiyuv. And that kinyan could be a kinyan kesef. In this case, a shavah kesef kekesef, that you're getting benefit from the fact that you tell somebody else, lend money, and he listens to you. It's an ego boost. And that ego boost is worth at least a nickel, is worth at least, people pay much more for ego boosts, so it's worth at least a shavah bruta. So that is enough to affect a kinyan kesef. The third sheet that we saw is probably what the Rush was getting at, that somehow the kinyan works on behalf of both at the same time. So the kinyan, that the third party, in this case the borrower, in the case of Kedushin, used her brother a couple times. So whoever is this additional person, when he acquires the money, that creates a kinyan on behalf of both of them, which might mean that essentially there is a bond now between them. So Jonah and Josh are now bonded to each other, so when Jonah borrows the money from me and benefits, it is Kielu Josh as well. And again, that's what they mean by the special relationship between a woman and a man. So that's the third model. The fourth model is it was some type of shlichus. That's how the Rashbam sounds. So basically, Josh instructed me to lend the money to Jonah, and therefore I acted as his shliach. And so ultimately, it's coming out of his pocket. And the fifth possibility is Muki Yosef, maybe the most difficult and most interesting at the same time, the idea that it works as a mazik concept, that basically I was not going to make this loan, and now I did it because Josh told me to, and now I'm out all this money, so essentially Josh got me in trouble, he made me lose money, so now I can come and collect from him that he should be able to make good for the damage that he created. Jedediah, Zebediah, what's on your mind?
The Rashbam seems to sound also a little bit like the Rush and the Tor, in that he says that the Arev is like the Lobe.
Right. So I think. Okay, so I think that's interesting. I want to address that actually in a second. Before I address that question, because it's in the context of another thing, are there any questions in terms of the basics, the facts of those five positions that we laid out? Are they all clear? Jonah?
You mentioned the fourth one again being between the Rush and the Mukhi. Which one?
Yeah, that's essentially the Shlichus idea. Right. Shlichus had been suggested in this room in different formulations. That here the idea seems to be that basically it is as if when the Arev, when in this case Josh, says to me, yeah, it's okay, lend him the money, he's basically saying, I'm lending him the money. So you just lay out the money for me to lend it, and I'll cover you. So essentially, those five could be grouped in a couple different ways, right? We could have just five views,
But we could group them in different categories. We could say maybe there's really three different categories of what's happening here. One category is to say that there is some kind of bond between the Arev and the borrower, and whatever is happening to the Arev is happening to the borrower. It's really what we associated with the Rush. We could say that there's no real bond between them, but somehow the Din Arev is creating the Schiv. The Din Arev either being Exer Shachasa, like Rashi says, or some type of Hiskaidos, like we're seeing in the Rambam, the Ritva. Or you could say that something that the Arev does is making him Chayev. So what did he do? Either he sent a Shliach to go lend money on his behalf, like the Rashbam, or he created a Hezek, he created a loss, and that's why he is Chayev. So it's just interesting to keep these in perspective, because these then allow us to see other potential nafkaminas. Essentially, what's happening? Is there some kind of bond between them? Is the Din Arev itself creating the Schiv? Or is there some third concept which is triggering this obligation? So it's also interesting to try to plug this back into the narrative of the Chumash. You know, what exactly is going on when Yehuda says his whole spiel? So what, first of all, made him win? Reuven was offering his two sons, which already you're talking to the grandfather of the boy, it's hard to see how this is such a tempting deal. But whatever it is, the whole exchange is a little interesting. But Yehuda somehow won, and some of the Mefarshim suggest that Yehuda won because he said he's going to take on the responsibility for Binyamin in this world and the next, which could be seen as a complete intertwining, a complete connection. We mentioned last time that the word Arev itself really means an interweaving. So we say in many different contexts, we say Kol Yisrael Areven, Zeh Bo Zeh. They say that a person should be Mu'urav Mabrios, that's the Gemara in Ksuvos, which talks about Kesav Arachtim Lifnei Hakala, that the Sila says they should always say the nice thing because it should be Mu'urav Mabrios, that it means to be mixed in with people, mixed in comfortably with people, mixed in terms of responsibility. So perhaps that's really the theme here. Or you could say that it means something else is in operation here. So for example, the Panim Yafos, which I guess a little bit of synergy, because the Panim Yafos is written by the author of the Sefer HaMaknes, so we've mentioned him many times in his commentary on Kiddushish. So his commentary to Chumash and Parshas Vayigash, so he asks that Yehuda says to Yosef, he says, how can I go back to our father? The Hanar and the boy is not with us. It sounds like he's concerned that how can he go back and feel like he's betrayed his father's trust? It's going to be such an awkward reunion. How can he do it? So the problem is, yes, you have to wonder if this is the kind of question that really has to bother you. But he asks, well, that's not the issue. The issue is that he accepted responsibility for him. So that's the problem. The problem is he's an Arev. So why is he invoking this, oh, how can I go back to our father and trusted me? So maybe you could say that that's top of the point. It's the same thing. That the Mechayiv is the trust. That the fact that Yaakov trusted him, that's what creates the Arvus. And now he's saying, listen, he trusted me, that's why I have this Arvus. So how could I go back and betray the trust? I think there are some interesting thoughts one can have, just if you follow this whole path, of the notion that, again, I know I've been kind of hitting you over the head with this, but just the idea that that narrative story in Chumash, which is not about money, serves as the model for this Din of Arev, and apparently it's the real source. That's itself going to be a very interesting path to go down in terms of trying to understand how these different models could be plugged back into that story. It's also relevant, just if you break things down this way, so Primosha has a discussion about this, the question of how to understand the Gemara in Bava Basra. So the Gemara in Bava Basra mentions this pasuk, and mentions also the Hana. So the question, what is the real makar? Is it basically a svara that this Hana creates a chiyuv? Or is it more than that? Is it something that is not self-evident from the Hana component, and therefore you need the Pasuk to be the source? So it's not clear from the Gemara Baba Basra where it's really the conclusion. Is it really that the Pasuk is the source, or is it the Svara that's the source? And is the Primosha notes, it probably connects to understanding what the mechanism is. Is this something which logically flows from the Hana, or is this something which is not so obvious, and you need the Pasuk in order to convey it, in order to get it across? What other possible nafkaminas do you think could come up from these different understandings? Can you think of any other situations that might be affected? Let's say I gave somebody the responsibility to make sure it wasn't so hot. Would that play out? Would that have any kind of... Well, actually, so that's a discussion in Polskim also. That, do you say that there's a concept of Ariv on a Maisa? Rav Nosson Geshtetner, I think we mentioned him a few times, right, the Tshuva Slaharus Nosson, he has a Tshuva about this. Let's say somebody accepts Arvus not on a loan, but on an action. Discusses, for example, somebody who says that you need to raise money for your yeshiva, so I'm telling you, hire this guy, he'll do it, and if he isn't successful, I'll go out and raise the money myself. So is there such a concept? You have arvus on a maisa, you take responsibility not just on a monetary debt, but also on action. So that may depend, again, on what exactly is the source. Is this a monetary concept which flows from monetary ideas, or does it have to do with something else? And again, the fact that the story about Yehuda is not about money, and if that really is the source, it would seem like it should transcend monetary ideas. An important issue that comes out from the Rambam also, and this is something that's discussed in Poskim because it has major ramifications, is the question of, can you have arvus after the initial loan? Do we assume that arvus is binding only b'shas matan mos? That it's only if Josh stepped in just now when I was considering whether to give the money to Jonah, so Josh stepped in and said, listen, do it and I'll cover it? Or what if it happened later on? I lent him the money and I'm getting upset and I'm walking around and I'm saying, you know, Jonah, he borrowed this money from me, I don't know what's going to happen, and, things are getting tense between us, and Josh says, you know what, don't worry about it, it'll be fine, I'll cover it if he defaults. So is there such a thing as an arvus that steps in the middle? So it's also a major discussion in the postgame. So for example, in the Tshuva Shol in the Darshan, which is written by Rav Leo Schlesinger, so a well-known machaber in Israel, it's written a lot of fascinating sorrow. So he takes up this question and he assumes that one of the ramifications of the Rambam's position is that it's not really tied down to an agreement at the time. Some of the understandings that we've seen are all dependent on the fact that the loan happened at your instruction. But according to the Rambam's idea that you can be mechayev yourself willingly, so presumably you can be mechayev yourself later too, even without the loan happening at your instruction. So you may have to deal with the asmachta issues, perhaps. And maybe the hana that you got from being listened to was a function of that, but maybe there are other ways to deal with that. So he assumes essentially that we could say that there are two types of arev, that there is an arev that happens at the time of the loan, and maybe that has one kind of mechanics to it, and there's an arev that can come up later also, and that's going to perhaps follow different procedures, but should theoretically be possible, at least within the Rambam formulation. Any other thoughts? Do you have any other possible nafkaminas you could think of? How about the following? Let's also just go back for a second to the particularly interesting idea of Mazik and the very interesting Ritva. Did I put that Ritva on the Mar Makomos, by the way, that Ritva in Bava Metzias? You had a chance to see it, right? It's very interesting. So just to spend another minute on that. So the Ritva is quoted in the Shita Mekubetzes in Bava Metzias, and it seems to be another example of the idea of the relationship between Ariv and Mazik. That on the one hand, so you could say here that the Ariv is a Mazik, that the Arev creates a problem by encouraging me to lend money that wasn't really a sound process here. It wasn't a good risk. So he got me in trouble, so that's why he has to pay as a mazik. So we noted that there is another example of that relationship, maybe going in the other way, in the Ritva in Bav Metzia. The Gemara in Bav Metzia talks about a question of somebody who has the opportunity to get wine at a lower rate in this place called Zulshaft. I guess this also could somehow tie back into our lunch and our pizza prices. But you have this opportunity to go back and get wine at a lower rate, so you send the shliach to go do that, and you assume he's going to do it, and then it turns out he doesn't do it. So now you can only get it at a higher rate. So the Gemara is a discussion about whether this original guy who failed to do it, is he obligated to pay or not? Is it asmachta? Is it something else? So the Ritva says, well, what are you talking about? Why is there even any conversation about this? Why should there be a responsibility to pay? And basically he seems to see it as a mazik kind of situation, that because he agreed to do it and I relied on him, so now I have a loss that is essentially mazik. And I think we noted the other day that basically these are two different halves of the same idea. That on the one hand, we're saying here that maybe one becomes an arev because of the did mazik. You become responsible to pay off a loan because of your causing a loss. And here, this Ritva is saying the other half of it, that you become a mazik because of the arev, that because there is a responsibility that's assumed, now you are responsible for the problems that you're causing in Kiva.
So, I mean, if we're saying it like that, why don't we just say it the other way, that the person who is supposed to give the, who is supposed to pay back the money is actually the mazik,
mm-hmm.
because he's no longer paying back the money.
You mean the borrower?
Yeah.
So any borrower is always a mazik.
Yeah,
well,
I mean,
right.
Why would you, it doesn't seem logical to extend the mazik idea to the third party who's just sort of...
Shlihei really tuffel chomer min ha'ikar.
Yeah.
Basically, you're saying it's an interesting question. I mean, there are other weaknesses, as we'll review in a second, to the whole mazik theory. But Akiva's question is, if I'm understanding it correctly, saying that why do you have to come on to this guarantor as a mazik? Let's call every borrower of money a mazik. Let's say that anytime you borrow something, you essentially, if you don't pay it back, so now you're causing the guy a loss, so let's say that's a hezek. Now we know we don't need that because we have the existing chov anyway, because he borrowed the money in the first place. But let's call him a mazik too. Which, by the way, could open up all kinds of very complicated questions. Because you could trip over some ribbis issues. Right, let's say I borrow money from you, so I'm not allowed to pay you more than I took, more than I got, because that would be ribbis. So if you want to call me a mazik too, and what if the damage ends up being more than the money I took? Right, let's say you can't function in your business because you didn't have the money when you needed it. So then, if you're going to ask me to pay you not just the value of the loan, but more, is that a ripus concern? Now, the truth is, this is discussed in Poskim at great length. That question that you're kind of bringing up, that what happens if somebody lends out money and the borrower doesn't pay back on time? And because he doesn't pay back on time, the lender loses something substantial. Is he allowed to charge the borrower for that loss? What would you think about that? Is that a ribbis issue?
Meaning like a late fee?
Yeah. A late fee that's not just arbitrary, let's say. A late fee is itself a question, right? That's also a big detail in Hilchos Ribbis.
Right.
But, in this Lamaisa, I generally assume that you can have a one-time late fee when it's not Derech Hava. So we have, like, NYU, they have that in the apartments. It's a whole discussion how that works out. But if you don't pay your rent in the apartments, NYU, they can charge you a late fee, and it's not construed as ribbis. But let's say even a little bit better than that. It's not Stam a late fee that's there to motivate payment on time. But let's say there was actual cost to somebody. I needed money for capital in my business. I thought you were going to give it back to me before I was going to start my business. You kept me waiting a month, and I lost money because of that. So can I pass that loss on to you? So it's a complex question, but there's a good chance that that's not Ribbis. And Professor Nochum Rackover has an article about this in one of the journals. I think the article is more than 100 pages long. And it's a complex question, but the question can be broken down into two halves. One is there any real debt there? Do you owe me any money because you caused me this problem, or is that just grama? So one question is there any legitimate debt to begin with? And the second question is, does paying off that debt create a ribbis problem? And there is a strong case to be made that it doesn't, that that's not something that was payment for the money, so to speak, it's payment for a different problem that you caused, and that that's legitimate. So it's a complex discussion. I mentioned this article is more than 100 pages long, but there is what to talk about. So Akiva, more to your point, there is a discussion in the postgame also. If you borrow something and you hold on to it past the due date, past the time when you're supposed to return it, so is that just a delay in the midst of paying off your debts? Or do you become a ganav at that point? So it's possible that you do. Now, if you become a ganav at that point, so then there's another whole discussion to have. Are ganav and mazik related concepts, which they might be? It's a whole other discussion. So you could say that in a chanami, the borrower maybe does become a mazik if until he's within the regular term of the loan. So then he's just a borrower. That's not, there's no hezek to talk about because it's normal. Okay, so I borrowed $100 from you. You willingly gave me the $100 and you were willing to go for a month without the $100. But once it's day 31, maybe in a chanami, maybe the borrower is a mazik. He's a ganav or a mazik. And then if that's the case, so then to say it's also possibly true about the person who provoked this whole situation, maybe it's not so hard to say. So it's an interesting discussion to bring up. So that being the case, there's still a number of weaknesses using this for the Arev. You're going to have to account for the causational factors. Normally, you're not chayav for nezek unless it's direct. This is pretty indirect. You could say that that's the whole chiddush of Arev, that Arev is about mazik and it's its own din, but it's a din that's basically about the mazik component, so it doesn't have to fit the rules of mazik. We have our own pasuk. But it could still be the nature of Arev is that it's a hezek type of idea. You got me in trouble making me trust you. And normally that wouldn't fit the rules of Mezikin. But because there's a chiddush of Arev, that's what makes up for it. That's what it makes up for the problems. It's still going to be a problem, as I think Yeshua pointed out last week, that plugging it back into our Gemara is going to be very difficult. Because how in the world does it have anything to do with Kedushin? And that's something, again, Rav Nassim Gestetman discusses in a tshuva where he doesn't like this whole Arev idea. And one of the problems is that it's hard to see how it has any relevance to the Kedushim context, and that's going to be a problem. Jonah.
I guess two things, I guess just addressing that quickly. Mm-hmm. It says Midin Arev, right? Meaning it's not actual Arevs, right? Meaning it's Midin Arev.
But what makes it work, though? So what would you say is the difference between Midin Arev and Arev?
I mean,
it could be that there is a difference. I mean, it could be they're saying that it doesn't have to hold on to the logic of Arev. Maybe what you're saying is that, listen, when it comes to a loan, there's a concept of Arev. Arev exists because of Mazik.
Right.
Now, here, there's no correlation to Mazik, but it doesn't matter, because once Arev exists, and it's a Mazik happens to be a Mazik history, but now we have a concept that a third party obligation can create an obligation on the two principles too. So, okay, so now we can transfer it over to Kedushin, and it doesn't have to follow the same thing. I mean, that might be true.
Right. And then, just secondly, in terms of, we talked about possible nafkamina for the different shitos. So, I was wondering if we could possibly talk about, first, the fact whether you even need a kinyan to be obligated in Arvus. And then, secondly, if even if there was that kinyan, could the kinyan be like a kinyan sutter, where there's no hana whatsoever, seemingly, right? It's a possible fruit or whatever it may be, or it's a kinyan sort of where it's returned to whomever and no one gets any belongings out of it. Would that be
nice? Yeah, probably should. Sounds like from the Rambam, but you don't really need a kinyan.
Right.
So it sounds like the only consequence of the hana is really maybe to deal with the asmachta,
right.
But it sounds like from there that you don't really need a kinyan.
Would a Would you consider not being able to stop that?
I probably would.
Maybe Nigo would do it.
Yeah,
that
probably would. So this whole Mazik idea is interesting. Jobidai is Abadai.
Which Chiluk is this spelled or
This was, I think it's in Chiluk Tesvav. He has a number of places in his Shulchan where he has this. Oh, he's beyond Tesvav. I mean, he passed away a number of years ago, but he got past Tesvav. Yeah. There are some Machabim now who are way past that. So believe it or not, yeah. It came in the recent decades. It started coming out much faster. So, in any event, but yeah, there's a Chiluk Tesvav it is. So, this August ritual, which is just fascinating, I think I mentioned last week the whole story about Ross Perot and how somebody tried to sue him for quitting his presidential campaign in 1992, and the basis was that they spent money and time on the assumption he was going to run for president, and now he dropped out, so he should be responsible for that. I thought at the time, oh, it's the ritual, that if you work on somebody's promise, then maybe that creates a chiyuv. It's a big discussion in Poskim whether the ritva is accepted the maisa, because you can imagine this is something that comes up a lot, and this is something that Dinei Torah are likely to revolve around. So it's a very important point, what exactly is the minhag hadayanim nowadays to accept this ritva or not, because it's very practical. Chassam Sofer has tshuvas where he seems to say the ritva is accepted the halacha, Chazanish thought it's not accepted the halacha. It becomes a point of great practicality. It's the kind of scenario you can imagine a lot. There are some who invoke the ritva in the context of another din. But there's a Mishnah in Bava Metzia. If you were learning Daf Yomi, this was 2 or 3 months ago, that the Mishnah talks about somebody who tells some workers that he's going to hire them. He says on a Thursday, he says to some workers, come to my office on Monday and I'll have some work for you. So the Mishnah discusses what happens if on Monday he just decides he's not going to give them any work. So the Mishnah says that if they're able to get other work, so they do get paid for that day, so then there's no claim against this boss who pulled out. The Mishnah says all they have is tarumas. They just have their grievance, whatever that means. It's a whole fascinating discussion of itself. But there's no actual liability. So the assumption seems to be that what if they couldn't get work? What if they thought they were going to get paid, and so they took themselves off the market, and Craigslist, whatever, doesn't have anything left to them? And had this guy not told them he was going to have a job on Monday, they would have stayed on the market, and they would have made sure to get a job. But because he said he's got a job for them, they stopped looking, and now it's too late. There's no more jobs to be had. So it sounds like from the Mishnah that, oh, if there is a loss to them, then he does have to pay something. Right? That he doesn't have to pay if they're able to get another job. But what if they can't get a job? Oh, he does have to pay. Again, this is something very relevant to halacha. This is the kind of thing that comes up also. That this is relevant to the question of doctors and others who charge for missed appointments. This kind of thing comes up, very practical question. So the Rishonim and others try to understand what is the basis for this debt. And if I say I'm going to hire you, and then I changed my mind, and now you lost the opportunity to make money for that day, so I'm sorry that you lost the day's wages, but what is the machayev? Right, you follow the question? Right, because you're going to call me a mazik, but it's a grama. And I didn't break your stuff. I stopped you from going out and making a living that day. So that's indirect. So why should there be any chiyuv? So the Rishonim have a number of theories, actually quite a fascinating sugya. There's 5 or 6 or 7 theories in the Rishonim as to why there should be any liability at all to the boss. It's not nice, but still, it doesn't seem to fit in the principles of Nezikin. So there are some who suggest that maybe it's the Ritva. That this is the Chiddush of the Ritva, that if you promise somebody something and they trust you, and because of that trust, they end up losing out, that is an actual Machayev. That is something that you actually have to pay for. And maybe that's a premise here of this Ritva. So again, there's a lot of practicality behind it, and it's a two-sided relationship that perhaps has to do with this Arev Mazik connection, if there really is one. And just to also to reiterate to Jonah's point, so we have two major problems, which the Lahoris Nassim discusses with saying that there's an Arev Mazik connection. One is it doesn't fit with our Gemara having any relationship to Kedushin, and also Arev doesn't meet the standards of Mazik. Mazik has to be direct, has to be via Dayan, etc., etc. But maybe, like Jonah was suggesting, we could answer both questions by saying that that's the chiddush of Arev, the fact that there is a din of Arev, maybe even if it's learned out from a pasuk. So then that overrides both issues. It means the concept exists, and therefore it can be used in the context of kedushin. And it means also that even if it doesn't fit the normal rules of mazik, it doesn't have to. It just is its own din. It happens to be based on mazik-like logic, but it's not something that has to follow the rules of mazik because it has its own sources. Okay, so far so good. Everyone following everything so far? Any other nafkamidis you can think of? There is a interesting tshuva that is in the Sefer Meshuv Kahalacha. Meshuv Kahalacha was published in a few volumes by Machon Lahora. Machon Lahora, again, if you want to get into practical monetary law, so you shouldn't know from it, but if you ever have an actual Din Torah, so you're invited to come to the Bezdin of America, or if you don't want to go there, so there is another often used Bezdin in Muncie called Machon Lahora. So Machon Lahora has a couple of volumes of journals and tshuvas that they have published from their Bezdin. So in one of the volumes of the Meshuv Kahalacha, he discusses what's the story with Arev. We know that, okay, so the Arev, at least in a normal Arev situation, there are other types of Arev, but in a normal Arev type situation, you're only supposed to go to the Arev if the actual borrower defaults. So what would you say about the following scenario? Let's say the borrower pays you back. But then, after he pays you back, he goes bankrupt. So what happens with bankruptcy law? So usually bankruptcy means that the person who declares bankruptcy doesn't have to pay back anything else because he is liberated from all of his obligations. But because it's not a great situation and there are creditors who deserve to get paid, so sometimes the law, the banks will do what they can to get some money to various creditors. So let's say, it could vary, let's say in the past month or the past 3 months, if the bankrupt individual had paid off somebody, you know, let's say he has 10 different people he owes money to, and he decides to pay off one of them and then declare bankruptcy, so the law might say, that's not fair. We're going to go and take the money back from that guy, and we're going to divide it up 10 ways. So this guy should only get 1/10 of what he gets, not all of what he gets, and the other 9 creditors should get nothing. We'll divide it up, we'll take it back, and we'll give it out in a way that's more equitable. So what if that happens? So let's say the guy who borrowed money from you, pays you back, then declares bankruptcy. Then the government comes and takes the money back from you. So now, can you go back to the Arif and say, I was never paid back? Or can you say, no, he paid you back. Government, they came later and took it from you. But don't come to me. I'm only here if he doesn't pay you back, and he paid you back. I'm sorry you happen to have bad luck with the government. It's not my problem. So that's an interesting question to ask. Okay.
Does it depends on
Rabbi Hanan and Sharis?
Oh yeah.
Does it have to last?
Yeah. Right, meaning no, it's isn't the important part that the money right, stays or comes to? Are we focusing on the fact that it's paid back and that it's retained by the person who keeps it, right, meaning by the commercial lender? Or is it just that the money is paid by the person who owned it?
Except that it's different. That is within the context of fiduciary. It's
right.
Difficult when you have to pay back a loan. It seems much more clear the money has to actually stay with the creditor. So to say that it could be done just because you paid it back and you're not responsible for what happens afterwards is a little trickier.
Or maybe that ponders the Arvus, is what I'm saying.
Maybe, that's the question. I think just the Arvus, that's the question.
Right.
So you're just there to cover that until he pays it back? Or should you say that, no, if the guy doesn't get to actually hold on to his money, then he still has the right to come back to you. So they, the Machon Lahara in this tshuva, they come to the conclusion that Dina de Malchusa Dina is the relevant factor. And that since Dina de Malchusa Dina, in this case, seems to view it as if the money is not paid back, they are basically retroactively nullifying this repayment of the debt, so therefore there was no payment from the Arev, but there was a very partial payment by the borrower, and therefore the Arev maintains his initial responsibility. Now, that's much they say. The whole question of Dina the Malchusa Dina is an interesting one, because in general, it's a whole discussion. We know they have this principle of Dina the Malchusa Dina, but we have to figure out what it applies to. So does it apply to monetary dealings between two Jews? So you could argue that maybe it shouldn't, because you have Chosh and Mishpat to regulate the monetary dealings between two Jews. So it's a big discussion, it's a shach and a chazanish. What exactly is the role of Dina de Malchusa Dina in things like this? So the shach has a position that Dina Malchusa Dina covers all the situations that halacha doesn't talk about, of which bankruptcy might be an example. Now, Chazanish found this concept offensive, because Chazanish wrote that there's nothing the Torah doesn't talk about. The halacha covers everything. You should have to read the book. And there's no such thing as a situation that halacha doesn't regulate. But if you accept the premise, so this could be an example that maybe bankruptcy is such a thing. Maybe bankruptcy is a new concept, and maybe Dina de Malchusa Dina should extend to bankruptcy. So it has lots of nafkaminas. It's a big issue. So Professor Reznikoff in Chicago, who's written extensively about this question, about Professor Reznikoff.
No,
it's not sure. Oh, there you go. Say hello. He has an article about this, I think more than an article about this, a lot of writings about what exactly is the story of bankruptcy. This has huge nafkaminas. If a person borrows money and then declares bankruptcy, so does the halacha recognize his right not to pay it? Or do you say, look, you borrowed money, you have an obligation to pay it? And what's the story of the Mishra Sadin? What if you win the lottery afterwards? Different questions about how exactly the halacha would view the concept of bankruptcy. In modern Hebrew language, if you want to know, if you want to read the tshuvas that are about it, so the expression for bankruptcy is pashat es harego, for some reason. So that's, you see that in the tshuva literature, that's what's talking about bankruptcy. So, A, does the concept exist? And if the concept exists, I'll be din. So then what does that mean? The money that was seized, that was confiscated by the government because of it, so does it view it as if it was never paid back? So essentially, that's the approach that Meshuv Kalacha takes, that because of the Dina de Malchusa Dina, it is as if the borrower did not pay back this money, and it's not considered to be paid back, and the Arev is liable, which is an important part of the puzzle, right? Because what would you say if the borrower paid back his loan? Right? I once had a situation like this a little bit, a less complicated situation. But let's say if the borrower paid back his loan to the lender, and then 10 minutes later, the lender got pickpocketed. Right? So, okay, he doesn't have the money anymore, but that's not the borrower's fault. Right? The borrower paid it back. So, you wouldn't have a havmina there that the lender could say, oh, I don't have the money anymore, I'm going to go back to the Arev and get it back. Because the Arev will say, listen, the borrower paid you back. The fact that you got robbed by some other guy 10 minutes later, that's not his fault, it's not my fault, that's the mugger's fault. Right? So you wouldn't have in that situation where the mugger came and took away the payment, no one would think that the RAF should have liability. So the only reason that we are even talking about it here, and maybe even concluding that you have it here, is because Dina de Malchusa Dina views it as the loan was never paid back. And it doesn't view it as if, oh, it was paid back legitimately, but the government just decided to confiscate it. So it's that crucial component, Dina Malchusa Dina, that makes it the responsibility of the ARIF. Does that make sense? So far, so good? So I think you could also add one more swara to this. And you could say that if you use the logic of mazik, then that might also fit here. That regardless of how we view it, regardless of where the dina malchusa dina comes in, still the fact that the lender doesn't have his money, it's not comparable to an unrelated mugger coming and picking his pocket. But it's still because of the irresponsibility of the borrower who ended up overextending himself and going bankrupt. So it's still a bad risk that he got into because of the Arev. So if Arev has a liability because he got you in trouble because he was a mazik, so then you could say that here too, that yes, the guy did pay you back for a minute, but because of his general issues and lack of trustworthiness, so it ended up getting snapped away from you a minute later, so then maybe that should still be the Ari's responsibility. Make sense? Now, in general, it's also a discussion, which will also correlate here. The halacha that we have, and again, this is only true by certain types of Ari, but the idea that in the Freud and Ari Pilo, that you don't go first to the guarantor and say, listen, I'd rather you pay me back, but you're supposed to first go to the actual borrower. And if the borrower defaults, then you go to the Arev. But if there's a possibility the borrower can pay you back, then you don't have the right to say, well, I still prefer to get it from the other guy. So there is a whole discussion to be had, which may also correlate to some of the svaras that we've seen here. Why is that true? Is that true inherently? Is there basically something that changes the hischaivus, that the hischaivus is only there if the borrower defaults? Or is it possible that, no, the hischaivus is there regardless? But Stam, the din is that it's not right to go to him first. That's basically kind of a deal you're making, that when Josh guaranteed this loan, so really, I'll be dine mominus, I can go to him and say, give me back the loan without even asking Jonah. But it's not right. There's a din, you're not supposed to do that. But the money really legitimately could be taken. So that could correlate to how Arvus works. You say that Arvus is something that's a result of the mazik, for example, and therefore it only comes up once there's been a default. Or do you say that essentially it's a hischaivus and that maybe it could theoretically could be true no matter what? Or especially, for example, if you say like the Rush, that it's as if they both borrowed the money, so then really maybe I should be able to say, okay, both of you borrowed it, so whichever one of you I choose to come to, you should have to pay me. So this is a tshuva about this. And the tshuva is Degel Ruvein. Familiar with Degel Ruvein? Degel Ruvein was Ruvein Katz. Ruvein Katz was the Rav of Petach Tikva a long time ago. Petach Tikva was a yishuv of Talmidei Chachamim going back a long time and before the Medina was established. So a long time ago, he was the Rav there. And his son, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Katz, was a Rosh Yeshiva here for many years, here in YU, passed away a few years ago. So Reuven Katz in the Sefer Degel Reuven has a discussion about this, and he basically assumes that probably, even if you want to say, for example, like the Rambam, that it's a hischaivus, but it's a conditional hischaivus, that basically Josh commits himself to paying the money, but he does so with a certain understanding, that there's a deal here, that I'm not going to do it stam, I'm doing it because I think I believe the borrower actually will pay back. So if he doesn't pay back, I'm agreeing to cover it. But if he's able to pay it back, I'm not committing in that case, and essentially it's a condition. Which is why then the issue of asmachta has to be dealt with, because once it's conditional and contingent, so then we have to deal with, well, maybe you thought it was never going to happen, and then maybe it's not even a real commitment, and that's something that we have to account for. Okay, any questions about anything that we've said so far? All right, so I would just mention one more in Afghanina. It's a little on the wacky side, but and the overly luminous, incredibly unlikely side, but it's also Purim-related. So it could be kind of Purim-Torah both ways. One, because it's, again, much less relevant than some of the cases that we mentioned in the past few minutes, which are extremely relevant, like we said. A lot of what we've discussed so far actually could happen, does happen, are things that are dealt with every day. The next point, which I'll mention if you'll indulge it, is Purim-related, and it's incredibly unlikely to happen. But there is a tshuva, again, in the Lahardos Nasim, which you'll just forgive for its Purim connection. So let's say as follows. Let's say Josh says to me that I think we should give Jonas and Shalach Manas. So I wasn't planning on it, but okay, you told me to, so I'll take on your arvus and I'll give the Shalach Manas to Jonah. Now, can that be considered as if I want to give it to you? Let's say I really wanted to give Shalach Manas to, I guess it's a more likely way to phrase it. Let's say I really want to give Shalach Manas to Josh. So I go to Josh's house and I say, here's Shalach Manas for you. And Josh says, you know what, I don't really need it. I think Jonah could use it more. So give it to him. So now I got to get on the plane, go from London to Los Angeles, and give it to him there. So my real intent was I wanted to give it to Josh. He's got that cool English accent going. And so he says, well, we just learned the sugya a few weeks ago. Purim is in a few weeks from now, right? So we just learned the sugya a few weeks ago of Arev. It'll work anyway. You know, like we did Arev. Give a Shalach Manas to Jonah. So can that work as Shalach Manas for Josh? So he thought it depends a little bit on what the Machayev of Arev here is. That if we say that it's as if the Arev accepted it also, so then good. So then the exact Hana of the Shalach Manas that's going to Jonah is also going to Josh, and maybe that should count. But if you're saying that it's only the Hana that I listen to you, and we have to quantify how much that Hana is worth, we're saying it's a Shava Pruta here, but maybe not much more than that, then maybe that's not really fashioned enough to count as Shalach Manas for Josh. So if that question is not obscure enough, so you might say, well, who really cares? Because I'm Yotzei Shalach Manas either way, right? Because I'm Yotzei Shalach Manas if I give it to Josh or if I give it to Jonah. So what difference does it make whether it counts as Shalach Manas for Josh? It should at least count as Shalach Manas for Jonah. So if it doesn't work one way, it works the other way. If it's not in London, it's in Los Angeles. Either way, it should be Shalach Manas. So here you get even more technical. And he assumes, which I guess could be true in this case, that mitzvah shrichos kavana, that Shalach Manas only works if you have intent for it to be Shalach Manas. If you happen to invite somebody for a snack on Purim without having any intent that that should be the mitzvah Shalach Manas, then presumably it's not going to count. So if this is my effort to give Shalach Manas to Josh, but it doesn't really count as if he's getting anything, so then in this kind of unusual scenario, maybe it's not going to be effective. All right, any questions about that? Or anyone planning on trying that on Purim and seeing if it works? If you do try this Purim, then let me know if it works, and we'll have a maskana to this question. All right, so let's just recap the additional points with the five sheets that we started with, so we won't recap those. But what were the additional points that we talked about? So we talked about the question of how we can regroup these into, let's say, three groups, of whether the two people are considered to both be benefiting, whether the Arev is not really benefiting but is just deciding to do this on his own, or whether he's benefiting in some side way, or whether he's doing something like Shlichus or Hezek that is Mechayifim. We talked about how that could fit back into the story in Vayigash and Miketz, and how we could try to use one as the source for the other. We talked about whether you could have Arvus on a Maisa too, not just on a monetary debt, but also on some type of action that you're committing to do. We talked about the significant question of whether you can become an Arev after the money has already been lent out. Can you come in later and be an Arev with obligation? We explored a little bit more the question of Arev as Mazik and the relationship between the two. And we mentioned the Ritva, how it's a discussion among contemporary poskim whether to follow it or not, and how it's been used to explain other things, such as the Mishnah Bava Metzia, that suggests an employer could have some liability if he pulls out of the agreement and the worker is not able to get new work. How could you explain that? And we talked also about the question of bankruptcy and how exactly could bankruptcy affect things. What if somebody pays back the debt, but then the money gets collected from the lender by the government because of the bankruptcy? So should the Arif still have to cover that? And we saw basically two ways to see why maybe he should. Because even if with some other situation, like a mugger taking the money afterwards, it would be clear that the Arif shouldn't have any liability. But here, maybe we saw two ways why there should be, either because of Dina Demofusadina, that's the way it was dealt with the Mishnah Kalacha, or because of Mazik, that maybe you're still a Mazik under those circumstances. We also said a little bit more about the whole Mazik Arif relationship and explored that a little bit. Kiva's question about whether we call any borrower a Mazik in the same sense. And we discussed the possibility that maybe it would be that while you're in the term of the loan, you pay back the loan on time, you're definitely not. But after the loan passes, so that maybe holding on to the money after the time when it's supposed to be paid back, maybe that is Ganav / Mazik. Ganav and Mazik might be related in a few ways. And then we talked about how that affects Hilchos Ribbis and a few other issues. Very, very practical questions, again, that really do happen. And then we talked about a very impractical question that probably doesn't happen, the question of can Shalach Manos be done midin Arev, and how that may depend on whether we see any Hana as actually going to the Arev, or even if we see only a small amount of Hana, is that enough? And that could affect the question of whether the Shalach Manos is really being carried out as intended. Okay, any questions about any of that? All right, so God willing, we'll just look at these sugyas together that are on the staff a little bit more, probably tomorrow, maybe Wednesday, and then we will move from there. So my last question for you, we'll find out hopefully at the moment we have a shiur schedule for tomorrow, which we can't do because Tuesdays don't work. So hopefully we'll find out that they're able to push it off to another day. So stay tuned. We're aiming for Thursday. And now we're aiming for Mincha. So who would like to daven for us? Kiva, you look like you're in the mood to Mincha for us. Ashrei Shevei Sacha, Adi Aluch Asala. Ashrei Shevei Sacha, Adi Aluch Asala.